It's Wednesday, October 16th, 2019, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Shepard Smith's on-air resignation from Fox News. It caught many by surprise, including Neil Cavuto, who came on the air right after him. We'll talk about why it happened, why now, and what comes next for the network. We'll also talk about the ripple effects from the release of Ronan Farrow's new book, Catch and Kill. There are detailed allegations of rape against Matt Lauer, new allegations he exposed himself to a producer almost a decade ago, and the questions about what folks at the network knew and when. And I want to ask Ernest and Kathy about a pretty complicated situation that's facing journalists at our sister station in Champaign-Urbana. Journalists at Illinois Public Radio told by their license holder, the University of Illinois, that has mandated reporters any tips of sexual harassment, misconduct, any kind of discrimination, really, must be reported to the university's Title IX office. What kind of chilling effect will that have on their ability to report effectively? And how are they working around it? But first, we're going to talk about that video that was shown over the weekend at President Trump's Miami resort, Trump National Doral. It was a scene from the film Kingsman: Secret Service, and places the president's picture on a character that violently kills people inside the, quote, Church of Fake News. It ends with the fake Trump character jabbing a stake into the head of a person with the CNN logo on their face. The last time that we were on the air was about 2 weeks ago, and we talked about the president condoning this type of behavior. Here we are talking about it again. But this incident feels like it's taking it to a slightly new level.
Well, I don't know. I don't even know what's new anymore when it comes to this. I mean, to me, it's another indication that there's a no holds barred kind of mentality when it comes to the president's supporters, and the news media. And this is just another example of that. And it was, you know, it was done in this in something that, you know, was sort of fashioned as a opportunity for his supporters to come together to help the president in terms of his reelection and that sort of thing. And somebody put this out there and said, "Hey, it was a joke. It was all meant to be in fun and in jest." But in light of what's been going on, what happened with the shooting at the newspaper in the Northeast, what's happening all over the country, this is another over-the-top kind of incident involving the president and his supporters.
Or if you want to go in the other direction, I like to think of this as the limbo era. How low can you go? and you know, this is, I think what's shocking about this, now, in fairness, President Trump was not at this event.
No.
It was a gathering of his supporters. But the governor of Florida was there, as was Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who is the former White House press secretary. And I think the fact that this group felt comfortable showing something like that in a public environment really says something. It goes beyond politics and beyond the press. It really, I think, talks about the coarsening of our public discourse. You know, I was reading an editorial in the Columbia, Missourian today about a homecoming gathering at another Missouri school, and it started out, meanness is having its moment. It talked about fan misbehavior. And I think what we're seeing just generally around society is this coarsening of the way we talk about each other and the way we talk to each other. And I think it's incumbent on all of us. It doesn't matter if you're a reporter or a politician or just an average citizen. I think we really need to get a grip.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that sort of bothers me about this is that, you know, there were people in the room, there were people who are supporters of the president, and as you said, in fairness, Sarah Huckabee Sanders says she did not see, she wasn't there at the time that this took place, even though she did attend the event. The same with the governor, but there were people there who were okay with this being shown. It was put on display, and so someone there, some official there knew. And then once it got out, there was really no sort of, well, you know, we're sorry about that. It was not meant to be this or not to be meant that. They just basically said, yeah, it happened. So what? You know, we move on.
Well, I just think I think what's disturbing about this is the fact that people felt comfortable showing something that's that out of line at a gathering in honor of the President of the United States does say something about the tone that is being set.
This is our
at
new
the White
normal.
House.
This is our new normal.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily. I mean, you know, I think when we say mm-hmm. that this is our new normal, we normalize it.
Okay, that's fair.
And I would say this is the opportunity for us to say, no, this is not normal. This is not the way
So where were those calls, though, coming from people who weren't journalists? Like, there's some things on our Links blog, including a really, really emotional reaction to this from one of the anchors on CNN who says, this is personal to me. Or Margaret Sullivan's piece from the Washington Post saying, the way we stop this is that the president has to stop condoning it. Where are the members of the public? Where are the other politicians? Where are the other people who are saying this is not
normal? I think that you did see some statements in particular from the Democratic candidates condoning and, you know, basically condemning this mm-hmm. And saying that, you know, this is not the way a campaign should be run.
Wouldn't it be really nice, though, if those were coming from the right, not from the left?
Well, yes, it would be.
Yeah, but we haven't seen that. Yeah.
We haven't seen that in the past. So why should we expect that now?
Yeah.
There is this effect that Trump and Trump supporters have in stifling any kind of sort of backlash against him from anyone within the right or the Republican Party. I mean, and if you sort of move over on that line and start condemning some of the things that the president, you're an outcast, you're ostracized.
I think this is part of the problem. The problem is that if you are a member of the president's party, you're afraid of alienating that group of people. And I think we've had a few people on the Republican side who have had a have you no shame moment. Mm-hmm. But I think we're still waiting for that to really become more widespread. But I think it's incumbent. It's really important for political leaders to understand that what they say and what they do, or what they don't say and what they don't do, has real impact. And what to some people might be just a satire, to other people, they're reading it in a much more literal fashion and acting on it in a literal fashion. And I think there are a lot of people who, if this resulted in violence, would be genuinely upset, but by not saying anything, they are making that possible. So I just think it's incumbent on all of us to, as I said earlier, get a grip. This is not the kind of society we want to live in.
So there have been a handful of other big media stories that have broken in the past few days. Let's start with Friday's surprise announcement. At the end of the 3 o'clock hour on Fox News, that Shepard Smith was parting ways from the network. He'd always been that one person that you could turn on Fox News and he would kind of be that voice of conscience, that one who would say, let's all get a grip and let's talk about what the facts of this situation are. This is a big departure there.
Yeah, it's a huge departure because, I mean, this is the one person on Fox News who would actually challenge, would challenge the president, mm-hmm. but, you know, would also challenge the other side as well. I mean, he was the one who was acting as that sort of person that says, wait a minute, the facts say this, and I'm going to go along with the facts regardless of what kind of propaganda is coming from either the right or the left. And now that he's exited the network, what's going to be there? To me, it looks like what you have here is that the propagandists have won. And this is what you're going to see on Fox News. I mean, you know, you would have some who would say that there's still a few people there who will sort of look at the facts and call it the way they see it. But it's few and far between now, and they don't have the stature that he had.
Well, I think this it undermines Fox it to lose somebody who is respected as a journalist. There are people at Fox who are very legitimate journalists who try to cover things in a traditional fashion, meaning that you're not favoring one side or another. But what's weird about, and it's happened, you know, Fox kind of started this, but other channels, CNN and MSNBC, have followed suit, where it's become much more opinionated and much more overtly advocacy journalism. And we've talked on this program about how discomforting that is, mm-hmm. and how we think it undermines the profession. So it's, but I think for Fox to lose, there are not, Chris Wallace is another voice on that.
That's the next one that comes to mind to me is kind of the next, perhaps, like beacon of truth.
Well, and it makes you wonder because this is a big price for him to pay. I mean, he is losing his microphone. I mean, he's clearly signed some sort of a non-compete agreement. He said he won't be on the air. So I just wonder what caused him to do this. Why did he feel, the network says they wanted him to stay, but why did he feel
that
so
he'd had his network moment.
Like,
he was mad as heck.
Yeah.
He was mad and he
This is NPR, right?
right. And it's the dinner time hour. But he had had that moment. And you could also tell, much like in the movie Network, like Neil Cavuto had no clue this was coming.
Right.
And he had the air right after. And you could see that look of just complete shock of not knowing what to say.
That's what I found startling yet refreshing was that he did it on the air because previous Fox personalities who have left weren't given that opportunity to actually say goodbye in the manner in which he did, which tends to make me think that, you know, the negotiations about it didn't happen until after he did it. But I could be wrong about that.
Interesting theory.
Yeah. Another one of those big stories, after weeks of promotion of pre-published excerpts, Ronan Farrow's book Catch and Kill has officially hit store shelves as of yesterday, and with it, fresh allegations against Matt Lauer. These are far more detailed and far more serious than what had been public at the time of his firing 2 years ago. This book has opened a lot of wounds again for people at NBC News and other media organizations. How much in there is really new versus how much is just simply in much greater detail?
I think it's details. I think the big question here that this raises, and really what people are talking about, is what did NBC know and when did they know it, and how far were they willing to throw other employees under the bus in order to preserve what they viewed as the franchise, this star. And, you know, we've talked about this before, but it's incredibly disturbing. And I think some of the links on the blog that you've featured talk about how now one of the NBC executives' college writings are being examined, and they're problematic in terms of how he wrote about women and talked about women. And, yes, that was decades ago, but people who are in college are adults, and you start to wonder how much of that thinking carried over and influenced decisions that were made at the time. So I think that's what the discussion is about. It's about to what extent did people in power protect this person
exert
and sacrifice
power.
Other people in the process.
Yeah. And again, you have NBC, both on-air talent and behind-the-scenes talent, questioning management about this. I mean, this happened after the initial allegations came out, Matt Lauer was dismissed. But now they're going like, whoa, wait a minute, this is even deeper and happened a lot earlier than what you had initially said it had happened, and now we want answers as to how long this has been going.
And that's what's new.
Right. And according to page six, there have been some very highly contentious town hall type meetings between the employees at NBC and some of those managers really wanting answers to those questions.
But one of the things that I find fascinating about this, and you have this on the Links blog as well, is that NBC is challenging Farrell on his allegations that he has in this book. Mm-hmm. And this is, I wonder if this is a new tactic.
Defense mechanism.
Exactly. That not only NBC, but others will be taking instead of just saying, okay, we're going to deal with this internally. This person has been suspended. They'll no longer be involved in our organization. Now they're saying, we're going to do that, but we're also going to challenge what is being reported out there by whoever, be it Farrell or whoever.
Matt Lauer has broken his silence, issuing a letter. It was an interesting read, if only because it is quite rich in its denials, and in fact, in a lot of cases, asking questions that we might consider to be a whole lot of whataboutism. What about the fact that after this incident, this person engaged in a consensual relationship with me? I couldn't have done anything wrong before that. Do you think it did anything to help his reputation? Or do you think it hurt him to even issue that statement into the depth that it did?
I mean, you never know. I mean, his reputation is pretty, you know.
It's shot.
It's pretty shot as it is right now. I don't think that this helped. But again, where, you know, he hasn't been in the spotlight since his dismissal. There was no indication that he was going to try to relaunch his career or anything like that.
Well, and interestingly enough, before this came out, maybe a day or two before, there were starting to be these little pop-up things about how he was now appearing in TikTok videos, like his daughter's TikTok account doing like lip syncs and dancing on social media. And it showed him as this happy, excited guy who was engaging with his kid. And within 48 hours, that entire narrative changes. On him.
I don't think there's any coming back. No. And you know, the letter is, you know, that's classic blame the victim. Mm-hmm. And it's so old. It's such an old hat defense. It defies credulity, given everything that's happened.
Okay, so reporting on issues of sexual misconduct and sexual assault, it's not just a big media organization issue. And we're seeing some of the cases hitting now into smaller newsrooms and that they're having to fight sometimes to the death to do the right thing. Okay, so fighting to the death might be a little dramatic, but I want to take a second to talk about what's going on at the newspaper in Carroll, Iowa. The editor of the Carroll Times-Herald has started a GoFundMe to keep the newspaper afloat after defending and winning a libel case about reporting that it did on a police officer's sexual relationship with a teenager. So often we talk about the health of small-town newspapers, and it centers around the idea of subscriptions and ad rates. Now we're looking at a paper that looks to be done in and done for doing exactly what a newspaper is supposed to do.
Yeah, and I don't think your introduction was overly melodramatic at all. And I think this is an actual tactic that's being used to try to suppress the news. The idea that if you have deep enough pockets, you can sue, and either you can take down the organization, even if what they print is true, or you are really exercising prior restraint by threatening to sue, that leads a lot of small organizations that are teetering on the edge for all the reasons we've discussed in the past on this program to not want to report those tough stories. It's real. It's happening. It's happening to large organizations and small. A year or so ago, you saw, I believe it was ABC, settle the so-called pink slime case, where they had reported on some dubious meat packaging.
The additive to hamburger.
Again, it wasn't because they acknowledged anything was wrong, but they did not want to be dragged into a lengthy legal proceeding that already had cost them quite a lot of money. So I think this is a very scary thing, and may require some public policy to address it.
Well, you know, this isn't anything new. I mean, one of the landmark Supreme Court cases, Sullivan versus the New York Times, is this case all over again, in which you have law enforcement to a certain extent using libel law to try to take down a media organization, and that we're talking about there was a civil rights case. I mean, they were basically going after the New York Times for reporting on the civil rights movement and some of the activities of Dr. Martin Luther King at the time. This is sort of along those same lines, and I think what happens in this case is that when you have a Supreme Court that has changed, that is much more conservative, and the courts underneath it that are conservative, you're able to see that side winning this argument as opposed to the journalism side.
Yeah, and I think the other new thing is that the news industry, which, you know, there were a series of really important decisions that were made in the 60s and 70s about public access to information that were thanks to cases like Sullivan that came up because news organizations had the deep pockets to hire the great lawyers to argue those First Amendment cases. Now, not so much. You know, the finances aren't there.
Well, and you talk about deep pockets, and you talk about the New York Times. This newspaper in Iowa, this GoFundMe, as of yesterday, had raised about $86,000 of $140,000 that it's going to need to keep this newspaper afloat. $140,000 is a lot of money, but to the New York Times, it's not.
Right.
To the New York Times, that's maybe one or two reporters. This newspaper is going to go away, potentially, for what a large media organization potentially pays one employee.
But the difference here is that if that newspaper had the resources to be able to appeal mm-hmm. all the way up, it may have been able
to
reverse
it.
I mean, I understand.
This is a situation they won the case.
But they didn't win it enough in order to be able to make it happen.
And one good piece of news here, and maybe I hope we have the GoFundMe page on our links blog for listeners who are interested, but one really good piece of news is that the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press has money, and they are going to put First Amendment lawyers around the country to help small newspapers, provide free legal advice and somebody to go to court for you. I think that is a terrific move to help guarantee that the public will have access to this kind of news.
And that the money that's spent on journalism is spent on journalism and not on legal fees.
Right.
Reporting on these issues isn't easy, but so often it requires the person to come forward and tell their story publicly. Illinois Public Radio, based in Champaign-Urbana, is a reporting partner of ProPublica Illinois. And at the bottom of each of their stories, they had a form asking people to come forward with their stories of sexual misconduct as part of their ongoing reporting. Well, and that presents a little bit of an issue. See, because like KBIA, the Illinois Public Radio station's license is owned and operated through the University of Illinois. And like all of us here at MU, U of I employees are all mandated reporters of discrimination and harassment. Thus, university officials said anything reporters learned about, either through that form or through their reporting, had to be turned over to administration as part of Title IX and discrimination reports. This is sticky.
It is. And I'm going to defer to the dean on this, but I want to just unpack that term for our listeners who might not be familiar, mandated reporters.
Okay.
It means that if you are a university employee and a student or someone tells you about a sexual harassment situation, sexual misconduct.
Any kind of discrimination. But yes, specifically.
You are mandated to report that to the Title IX office. Mm-hmm. That is what that means. But Dean, take it away.
Well, I mean, you explained it absolutely. I mean, this is where things get a little tricky, because are we talking about employees of the university, or are they employees of ProPublica? Are they working for ProPublica? And in that capacity, and in the practice of their journalism, then I would say that they would probably not fall under that. But then again, we're back to lawyers. So. Mm-hmm. And my philosophy has always been, when I'm not sure, I'm calling a lawyer. Okay. And so I'm pretty sure that the station at the University of Illinois is trying to work with Title IX, trying to work with the lawyers to try to figure out.
They have kind of worked out a solution here. And the way this has worked is that it's part of ProPublica's local news network initiative. And so what ProPublica has done is, in a way, taken the University of Illinois employees out of that, where that form, where that reporting goes directly to ProPublica Illinois employees who are based in Chicago at ProPublica Illinois, so that the University of Illinois employees are never in possession of that information to alleviate them. But it does kind of create just a bigger picture question of that idea of protecting sources for journalists, depending on who your employer is.
I mean, it does create a situation, because if you have a journalism program in which you have students who are training to be professional journalists once they finish their degrees, and they run up against these stories, as they are likely to do in a university setting, who there is the obligation to the larger public that they're trying to serve, or is the obligation to the Title IX office? Now you got a quandary there, and you're trying to, and there needs to be some sort of I don't know if it's a legal opinion or some sort of a ruling,
yeah.
Some sort of carve out. But that's something that I think needs to be addressed, not only probably there, but at all.
Well, and I'll tell you, I was hesitant to bring this up here for the fear of opening the can of worms about what this could mean.
Well, I think this Illinois case has probably already opened up that can of worms.
Yeah, I think it has very wide implications, as Ernest has said, because increasingly, because of the financial problems we've talked about mm-hmm. so much on this program, nonprofit journalism is becoming an important part of the media ecosystem. And a big part of that nonprofit ecosystem is university-driven journalism. We're seeing more and more universities copy what we do here at the University of Missouri, mm-hmm. which is have students go out under the supervision of professional practice professors, meaning folks who have worked a long time in the business, and do the kind of reporting that otherwise wouldn't be done.
And public media outlets, because of the way the licensing works, become a natural outlet
exactly.
to create
right.
and to do that
right.
with for a public university.
And so what do we do? So that's why I think it's probably good that this can of worms has been opened, because we have to resolve it if we want to keep serving the public.
Right.
Okay. Well, we are just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today and a couple we didn't quite have time for. Check out our links blog. You can find that under the programs and the podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your favorite podcasts and download those. We're on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch, listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, and see previews of what we'll be talking about next week. Our thanks to Aaron Hay for serving as our audio engineer today, and Tim Pilcher, who composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.